This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
Like I said this morning, I was hoping that whoever showed up here this afternoon, we just had a few, discussion points here that you really care about. I will just take a few minutes and give a little bit of a quick view here of the issue, one of the issues that I care about and that I'm hoping that principals, administrative people, parents, I've used some of this material in talking at ministers' meetings and places like that. Okay, so, and that's the reason I raised it. In fact, I heard overtones in Mark's talk this morning from things that he and I have talked about that sort of jumped out from some of this material here, and I was so glad to hear it. He referenced, for example, of 1 Corinthians chapter 3, which was what actually pushed my buttons first on the issue of culture. And I realized that the passage that is quoted the most often there is the one that there's no other foundation other than Christ, which I agree with 100%, but it is not the point of Corinthians, of 1 Corinthians 3. The point is there, okay, that's established, that's sure, there's no dispute about that. I want to know how you're building on it. Okay, that's what Paul's asking there in chapter 3, because he's already observing in the early church that what's happening is there are followers of Christ. They are, they're building on the foundation, but oh my, what are they building? and so that set me to thinking, Paul's pointing in the direction of, I use the term culture here because you could apply it individually. So what am I building with? And you can apply it corporately. So how are we building on Christ? Mm-hmm. Okay. And the more I thought about that, the more I got into it, the more I realized how powerful culture is. I grew up in an era, Ernest, when in my circles, a lot of things were fluffed off by just simply saying, well, it's just culture. I began to say, well, wait a minute here. If you said it's culture, I want to know a little bit more about it, because you're saying something. Mm-hmm. The culture does not grow up in a vacuum. The traditions and practices that we call culture, they're deeply embedded, and sometimes, we do answer, we don't really know why we do it this way, we just do it this way. But there is a reason. So, and I began to say, when people said to me, oh, it's just culture, I said, well, that's exactly what I want to talk about. That's precisely the point. Because it is so powerful. If you actually sat down and listed your practices and the things that you do, and began then to write a sentence about how it's linked to culture. At least it surprised me when I started doing this. I always tell this little story when I'm talking about it. Here was another one that got me onto it. So you know the story likely from Alexander Fleming and the discovery of penicillin. Okay, so he's doing cultures in a Petri dish. The short form of the story is that in observing that culture, he's just doing these things. He's got maybe 50 of them sitting there trying to have them developed and all. I don't remember what his goal actually was, but he walks out of his lab. Next morning he walks in, and just as he's walking along, sort of just looking at them, he says, one to die, that one was botched. He looks back at it again. He says, well, that's strange. Here I'm trying to grow these bacteria, which If I jump, I'm just going to skip around here a little bit since so I can go rapidly. Yeah, said I was going to. I don't know why these things, when they're running on, takes them a little bit to wake up when you stop for a bit. Da-dum. Yeah, like I said, it says,
when we get to heaven, these things
go. Oh, don't we hope so. You know what? I'll just do this and start over again. Let me open that one now if I can. Well, apparently, this is relatively unimportant. Go here.
We got a paper somewhere?
Yeah, we do, but it'll come up here, I think.
It's a little circle.
Well, I thought it would, but... You know what? Yeah, we can just use the papers there. That'll be fine, because I have one here myself. Let me mute that. Let me just have a seat here and we'll talk some. So if you see there in the bottom left-hand corner, it's what Fleming saw. So the little streaks, they call that a streak bacterial colony. So if they're trying to isolate a particular bacteria, they do those streaks. And so the movement back and forth is his attempt to grow a certain bacteria. What he observes when he comes in is this mold, which would have ruined his, but what he saw is, if you look around the bottom perimeter of that, the bacteria are dead. Now think culture that grows things. Think this is what we want to grow. Here's a contamination. And the contamination around the perimeter of the contamination, he sees that the bacteria are dead. And a good bacteriologist immediately raises up, now what happened there? Why are those bacteria around that perimeter dead? The long story is that was a discovery of penicillin. Okay, that as he dug into that and found out that the mold was producing a chemical that was killing the bacteria, well then he isolated that chemical to see how it would actually work. Now let me tell you something, there's a lot of chemicals that will kill bacteria. But the trick here is there a chemical that will kill bacteria that will not kill you? There are lessons involved in that Petri dish here that are just amazing when you think culture and you think, what will it grow? What dies there? What causes it to die? Incredible. There's hay to make there on that one. But that set me down to asking some questions. Okay, so culture matters, gentlemen, I'm telling you. It matters big time. And it can be negative, but it actually is more positive than it is negative. We all are in a huge sea of culture that moves us along. We do things and believe things and act out things that we do almost strictly because of culture, which is what the slide is about. If you look on, if you flip the page and you're looking at slide number 9, it says values or vision behind, vision behind vision. Okay, now, administrative strategies, what I'm wanting to get to is three words here, vision and values. And you'll notice that I start out in slide 8 with vision. Okay, I heard growing up that without vision, the people perish. that's a biblical statement. I believe it fully. But I began to realize that, you know what, you can't... Vision doesn't grow on trees just to be picked and eaten, and now we have vision. You can preach to people all day long that they ought to have vision. And you might even have one a bit in your mind, but that doesn't mean that they have it. And so I began to ask myself the question, so, well, vision's important, but what in the world is a pathway toward it? And in administration, brothers, and even this missus here, if we can somehow open a path here, I think, and schools, I think, have opportunity. That's what I want to push out here just a little bit. So most of that slide on number 8, if I'm talking to my life and leadership men, that I walk through that a little bit, and you know, it's in the organization, the outward organization grows of a school, a church, whatever, grows out of a vision, okay? A business is that way. And you're just seeing that to the right. So what I'm doing with these slides is going backwards. I'm going deeper. I'm backing up, not going forward. So I'm asking, okay, well, if you're talking about job descriptions and structure and so forth, well, that flowed out of some kind of vision. If it didn't, I can tell you right now it's haphazard. It grew out of some kind of a vision of what we actually wanted. And even structurally, if you talk about architecture, it can be that way. If you get down into our dorms, what you'll see is dorms, and you'll see a little sitting room and all of that. Well, that was designed to try to keep, to make sure that the guys didn't spend all their time in their bedrooms. That they, I don't know if it worked or not, but that was the idea, that that's, you know, where you're to be together, so forth. But don't want to stay there too much. The next slide, number 9, is about values. It says, well, behind vision is values. And so you cannot take student Tim in grade 11 and stuff something down his throat and have him come out on the other side, a visionary in the congregation. You can't do that. I can tell you right now, doesn't work. Okay? Why? Well, because he lives, he and she and you and I live out of our values. When it comes right down to the bottom line, that's what we care about. So clearly, if you cannot, you have to touch the value to touch the vision. Okay? And then what you see there is a little bit of an analysis of that. So where do these values come from anyway? This has been really helpful for me. Now, most of this is my work. I pulled some of it from some others, but a lot of it is just thinking through this and trying to, take a look at the culture-driven values. Now think broad culture. Don't think, when I'm talking to young people from this, I don't go to our own culture. The example I give, this is a story I love to tell. I had a great friend, he's dead now, in Poland, Jan Wierzchowski. And Jan, I'll never forget this conversation. I'm at his place there in Minsk Mazowiecki, and we're up in this old attic that is, I don't know, it's an old post office. I don't know if you've ever been to Eastern Europe or not, but it's old Eastern Europe. This was not anything modern. This was the old stuff, you know. Ceiling about that high. For me, I was almost it. And I'm sitting there, and he's there talking to me. And here's this guy who's been, I mean, he's been through the mill. He was a captive of the Nazis and worked in their munitions factories. And he had a lot of stories to tell. I'd love to tell you. But this one. He said, he leaned back, and it's kind of in his broken English. He said, I have a question for you, Melvin. That's what he called it. He said, you all have very, very nice lawns. He's been over here before, you know. He said, I can't figure it out for the life of me, he said, you. And I should tell you, his front yard was a herb garden with a few flowers. He did have a lawnmower, a little push lawnmower, but he didn't. There was nothing more mowed than about a quarter of this room. Okay, the rest of it is herbs and a few tomatoes. And so I don't get it. He said, you spend a couple thousand dollars making this really nice lawn. And then he said, you go out there every week, and he said, you mow it off and nice and clean, and the next week you come back and you do the same thing again. And then he said, I don't know, it seems like you enjoy that so much, you put fertilizer on it and spray on it so that you can maybe do it twice a week instead of, he said, I don't get it. Gentlemen,
lady,
I do that because I do that. At my place, I do that. I don't fertilize it and I don't spray it. But I keep a nice lawn, and I'm telling you, that is culturally driven. And you're far better off just to admit that than to try to chew around and act like, make it into some kind of holy adventure. The fact is, I do that because that is what Western culture dictates that makes you a reasonable person living in this society. You have a lawn and you keep it mowed and you keep it neat and so forth and so on. Okay, but how many things fall under that category? That same thing, it is driven culturally. So, here's the thing, what I have found, it's just good to admit that it's that way, okay? And there's a whole host of things like that. Of course, there are principle-driven values. And these, I hope, we derive primarily from Scripture. But again, think about this for a moment. You don't twist arms on this. I know many, many people who grew up in Sunday school classes have been taught, even heard John Martin talk about how terrible materialism is, but they're still, they really made very few changes. The principle-driven values we love and we ought to embrace, and my life has been changed at various places when I actually permitted a principle-driven value. When I say principle, I derived it outside of myself. I derived it primarily from Scripture, possibly through the teaching of my pastors or whoever, and actually said, you know what? That must be so valuable that I need to make some changes here. If I really believe what I say, and that is that the Holy Scriptures, particularly the teachings of Christ and the New Testament, are priceless. The Scripture says they're priceless. And Old Testament as well. If that's true, pray tell, why wouldn't I pull out all the stops to align my life with those values? If I really believe that, and you're not looking at any saint here waving any white righteous flag here or anything like that. But you know what? If I were to give one thing that set Sheila and I on the track that we ended up taking, it was this point. And we said, you know what? If what we've been taught is true, and if we really believed that Christ is Lord, and that the greatest value in this world is to align my life with His, well then, let's just quit playing games about that, and let's just do that the best we know how. And believe me, I could tell you of failure after failure after failure. But I would say it was a thing that about 22 years old that set us on a trajectory that just was, I don't know where I would be if we had not taken that trajectory. So principle-driven values. Now I can tell you that the typical 10th grader would agree with you if you told him or her the script in your constituency, if you told them, look, the Bible is true and you ought to study it and you ought to obey it, they would agree with you. Let's say it this way, sometimes you wonder if they're agreeing or not. Because I want you to note the hero-driven values. This was the one that all of a sudden I just became acutely aware of. So there are cultural-driven values, I'm talking about popular culture, that are embedded, that people are doing just because that's what they are. They don't know that, but that's what they're doing. We lip speak to it. Don't hear me being critical, just hear me trying to describe what it's. Our lips agree to the principle driven values. Our lives, particularly the younger we are, at least this was true of me, the worse this is, but heroes, I'm telling you, you're not going to overcome the hero. A young person, a high schooler, derives almost all of their primary values from their primary heroes. Okay, and it is very hard to fight against that. So if you're thinking about administrative strategies, again, a direct assault to go tell somebody, why in the world are you listening to the music by so-and-so and so-and-so? They're not going to hear you. But if you can, again, in some way in the school, a daily dosage of now, your heroes are who and why? Again, not a direct question, but just so, oh, you were, you know, sometimes I overhear somebody talking about a great basketball player. And I'll maybe say something, well, maybe I'll give you this example. So when, Jordan's not here, but I tell this story periodically, and it's he's just a little guy, about 6 years old at the time, and he had a pack of basketball cards that he'd gotten from, I don't know where he got them. I always like to make sure you know that I didn't give them to him. Maybe I did, I don't even know. But he's got these basketball cards, and he's sitting there on the sofa, and he's leafing through them, looking at their pictures and all that. And now and then talking and saying something. I sat down beside him, kind of a little smile on my face. I said, Jordan, does it say on that card there, how does that mean pray every day? Yeah. He kind of intuitively saw where I was going with this, you know, and looked at me and smiled. Wow, no, he said it doesn't. I said, does it say on there if he's had 1, 2, 3 wives or where he's at? Wow, he said, no, it doesn't. I didn't take his cards, I didn't smack his fingers, I didn't anything like that. All I wanted to do was have him think just for a moment at least. Is that guy really worthy of being a hero? Is that really the case? It's better to ask that question than it is to kind of just slap him on the face and say, you know, what do you think you're doing or whatever. It's far better to is it really the case? Think about this for a moment. So you can sit down at the supper table and you can have this, I don't know, this glorious discussion about this guy who, and I happen to like long distance running, and my boys were into some of that, who's run this marathon and I don't know, 2 hours and 30 minutes or whatever, and it is impressive. Attention turns to the bishop of the church and you pick all of his faults out. You know, it's kind of like, it's hard to have that same sense of hero. Why are all the heroes out there somewhere, pray tell? People we don't know. And I often say to younger people, I say, well, listen now, you know, most of those people who are the popular heroes could not manage what my bishop did. He lived with one woman all of his life. And as far as I know, he was faithful to her. And he raised a couple of children, and they are very fine, upstanding people in the community, and they're making contributions there. In my opinion, he's a hero. That guy couldn't do it. He might be able to lift 1,000 pounds on his back or whatever. I don't know if he could do that or not, but so what? Which one is more worthy, pray tell? It's this kind of comparisons. I'm being a little strident here about it, but if I'm talking to young people, I'm not as strident. But I want to raise those categories. Okay, administration in the school. Over there's a bulletin board. Okay. Well, what gets posted on that thing? I mean, our schools do pretty well here, as far as that. there are subtle ways in which we communicate to family, to church, to people around us. These are worthy of hero status. You know, Psalm 15 makes an very, very interesting observation. You remember that psalm ends, "He that doeth these things shall never be moved." Okay, you did that. Now remember, as a young man reading that, thinking, huh? So, talking about stability in an unstable world, so what are we talking about here? You can go back and look at the psalm yourself, but one of the pieces in there is, "In whose eyes a vile person is contemned," C-O-N-T-E-M-N-A, but is contemned, "but he honoreth them that fear the Lord." Makes that one difference right there. There's your hero thing. Okay. By the way, the word contemned is normally, it's not condemned as if he's done for, but the word is despised. It's often translated that way. It feels a little strong to me. I don't know if we should despise people, but by comparison. Okay. So I find that very interesting. And the fourth one I have there is liturgy or tradition-driven values. And these now, I am talking about your own local tradition. A clue on this one is, Ernst, did you ever attend a love feast back in the Chambersburg area ever?
Luckily so.
Well, so here says Jeremy, he knows all about this. You know, one of the richest memories from my youth is in one of their churches. Back at that time, they still met in the barns. The Hearst Group doesn't even meet there anymore, do they?
They offer the big annual one. They'll often still meet in the barns,
okay,
even though they have their meeting house.
Okay. So I'm a youngster, probably 10 years old. My dad would take us to Love Feast. I don't know, once a year. And in the fall, it couldn't get better, you know. Here are these old white bearded men around the table in this barn, clean as a pin, with hay stacked in certain ways, and old meter music, and all of this. We were sitting there on the benches, and you know, sunlight coming through the slats of the barn and shining in there in an evening. That's a tradition, a liturgical tradition in some ways that the River Brethren have. That is just deeply, deeply rich and carries with it, I have no idea what all it carries with, but I know it's a load. I know that for sure. And I could name some from my own congregation growing up, just that sense of what endears you to things. This is the value of doing things the same way in a school every year, so that when you hear a first grader say, "I can't wait until I'm in 10th grade because," and then they fill in the blank. Here's what they do in 10th grade. You're on the right track. It's that type of thing that actually draws them in. Okay? And schools have an opportunity to do that. And it endears people and endears students. And I just would encourage you to think through that. What are the traditions that we should do every year? And what are the ones that are endearing, that actually, they don't sidetrack people from following the Lord, but they draw their hearts into community. Strategies that create community. They draw their hearts into it. Okay, and those are the things. I have to tell you this, and this was hard work. In the community I grew up in, I have a listing back here a little bit later on that I can share with you. But the community I grew up in, they didn't, when Anchor Christian School got started, they didn't sing. The boys did not sing. It was ungodly to sing. Or at least unmanly, you know. Well, John D. Martin started to teach in that school. And of course, he's a singer. And he announced at the beginning of the year that by the end of the year, all the boys would be able to sing a part. and they resisted it like you wouldn't believe. And he pushed back hard on them. And by the end of the year, John Mark said there was one boy who could that could only, his range was only do, re, and mi. And he was apparently tone deaf, and he couldn't hear things. He couldn't tell the difference between a low note and a high note. And so John was quite convinced the only person you can't teach to sing is a tone deaf person. He said that, and you can't help him. Anyway, the funny in church hymnal, they used a church hymnal. I promise you, if you go to Chambersburg, to Cumberland Valley Conference today, and you announce that we are going to have a hymn sing on Saturday evening or sometime out of the church hymnal, and we're going to sing the songs that we sung over and over at school, that church will be full. Why? Well, that became a tradition. First of all, it actually became traditional that when you enter high school, you will learn to sing, and you'll get the support to learn to sing. And it wasn't but 5 years until it would have been an embarrassment not to be able to sing. There was a cultural shift in the community almost within 10 years. They normally can't happen that fast.
Is that where the time and tune came from?
That's not where it came from, but they used that some. That was an old Chambersburg. You know what? When I was a boy growing up, they would have reunions, time and tune, singing reunions. It draw a big crowd of people from across a broad spectrum. I have that in your list there. Song, folks, there probably is not a more powerful culture shaper than song. I'm not going into a big discourse about the right stuff and the wrong stuff right now, but I'm telling you, don't dismiss it. they're very, very powerful. And that's why I really, really appreciate most of our schools have some emphasis there. I suppose it can be overemphasized. I'm not going to argue that, but I can tell you one thing. There's nothing quite like it. It's nothing quite like it. I tell this story now and then too. My sons are much more of singers than what I am. But they, when our family gets together every 5 years, we get together more often than that. But we have on our 45th anniversary, so we got together and we all have about a weekend that I have one of the boys bring men's music and. Maybe a new song, maybe something we've sung before. And somewhere along the line, we'll gather around the table, stand up. The ladies are doing something, we'll sing men's music. And you see the little grandsons, they're just little guys. They are the greatest admiration of their uncles that you ever saw in your life. I mean, it's like, whoa! Well, I know they're being drawn in. They're being drawn into a tradition that I want them drawn into. Okay, and there's their hearts being ministered to in ways that I don't quite know how it works, but I know it works. Okay, it's that kind of thing that I'm talking about here. And as administrators, we have a chance to introduce those kinds of things into our community and into our school. That maybe not song, but that one I would really encourage. It's a natural fit for us for the most part. But there are a number of things like that we can tap into. And they're community builders. It also fascinates me back in our home community. That's an old Mennonite community. So yeah, now and then we'll have somebody come there to the community. Have you known Clarence Fretz? Clarence Fretz taught in... Did you know? No, you wouldn't have known.
I know the name.
That's because he would have been an icon of of education back in the day. He's dead and gone now.
Yeah.
What did you ever meet his son, Paul Fretz?
So.
You know Paul. Paul's a good man. You might know him. He's in BMA. He goes down to there in Chambersburg area to Arlen Hagee's church.
Paul Fretz.
Paul Fretz.
Yeah.
Well, Paul was. Grew up quite conservative, left the conservative groups pretty much altogether, and then returned. And the things that he loved to come back to, even in the years that he was out wandering around, he'd come to hymn sings. Mm-hmm. Clarence was quite the musician himself. Mm-hmm. And Paul, those were the things that he said. Oh, he said, I really, really miss that strong congregational music and so forth. And so, forth. So there you go. Let me just push the pause button there. Yeah, questions or comments? What I'm trying to hold in front of you is something that's a little nebulous, but what can you do in your schools that point toward the values? That they're old values, and you deliberately intend to create the, create the circumstances where the youngsters have a chance to tap into the values that have been long held.
Yeah, question about the categories. So a few years ago, some of us met and we talked about whether we should push a new model. Do you recall that meeting?
I do. Is that the one that there were quite a few younger folks here?
I was the youngest, but it
was, okay.
You know, Brandon and Steve and Gerald and Patrick and...
Okay.
At the Pleasant View. Anyway, so, should we consider a different model? And you threw the cold water on it. I don't know if you remember that.
No, I don't.
At the end of the day, when opinions were asked, you said, do you think we should stay the course and just try to keep working with what we got? And my question is, and that's, that's all right, but the categories we have in our schools have been delivered to us by the nation state.
Uh-huh. Okay, I see where you're headed.
We have kind of tried to sanctify them or Jesusify them to certain, to greater or lesser degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But... Is it of any value to consider, when we think of a graduate of our school, we're largely bestowing on them the categories that we're training them in have been bestowed on us by the nation state, and we transfer them or try to with some tweaking. Mm-hmm. But are those the right categories?
Name a few.
The ability to write well.
Mm.
The ability to be healthy and sustain physical activity. Mm. The ability to do math up to the point of being able to conduct business. The ability to understand history, at least in the categories that are accepted. So what is being left out?
Mm-hmm.
Like if Jesus would get a hold of this high school, what would it look like? What would he train these men and women in?
Or I think of Christopher Dodd, haven't you had some emphasis with his approach?
Yeah, we've talked about his approach a fair amount. But what comes to mind here, if I were comparing what I never heard, absolutely never heard in a public school, was the word humility. I don't think I've even heard him use it. I don't know if they had a category for it or not, but it was all about, my education was about training to make the top dollar, mm-hmm. and training to, just training to be number one. Mm-hmm. That's what it was about. And I certainly would resist that model, by all means.
You wouldn't resist excellence.
Oh, no, not at all.
But it's the comparison.
Yeah. the competitiveness and you need to get a good education or you'll be nothing more than a ditch digger. Well, ditch diggers are good people too. Well, not all of them, I know, but I'm just saying that.
So the categories, can we adequately, we don't want to produce young people who buy into the nation state's economic categories, but do we give them the tools to actively resist or to actually live a different way?
That's an excellent question, Arlen.
And how would the structure, we can think about how we change, how we teach the subjects in a different way, but the whole structure of the school. I think of like the Bruderhof who has afternoons outside, for example, and how that shapes the understanding of the world. I could think of other examples. So I don't have answers. I just have questions.
Well, you're touching on a good point there. I did say, maybe I should quit talking here and have some of the rest of you. Daniel, what are you here?
I'm still thinking.
You're still thinking.
So we know we want to produce Christ-centered, humble servants. We're all agreed on that, right?
I think we are, yes.
So how is that best done? Is our curriculum devoted to that? Maybe the curriculum is the teacher, if it is. But do we provide the kind of structure and activity for that to flourish? So we expect them to do math until they can be proficient. What does it look like for a 18-year-old to be proficient in discipleship or in service?
Mm-hmm.
And should it be measured? Should it be expected? Like, what are the qualifications for graduation? What if you're an ace in math and literature, but you can't love your neighbor? Should you get a diploma? So how would we, and I'm wondering, should we have two different tracks, like one for the Jesus followers and the ones who haven't decided yet, you know? Because I would like to take these young people and if they're committed to following Jesus, just push them off the deep end. I mean, get them going. And what we expect from them by the time they're 18 is part of the trajectory that they'll be on. Mm-hmm. And just some community service twice a year probably isn't quite enough.
Mm-hmm.
I understand humility being in the water is a huge. Mm-hmm. But how do the practices, the things that we actually spend time doing in school, how does that either build or foster humility or detract from it?
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. So, Jeremy, I'm wondering what you're thinking there when you're hearing Arlen push us here a little bit on this point.
Yeah, I've thought about this before too, and I haven't come to any brilliant conclusions. Am I hearing you say, in a sense, we're using like liberal arts categories,
yep.
And the way high school's set up would be prepare you for college, and
college or military,
the way the world's operating now, it keeps coming back. So kindergarten is to prepare you for school, school's to prepare you for high school is to prepare you for college, and then a bachelor's degree is no longer enough to set you apart, so you need a master's, etc. And And so, in a sense, we're, how we've learned to do school is from that system. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I think we're limited because we live in the nation state and we have laws that require us to learn certain things, but in other ways, I think we could be more creative to branch out, but I think it comes back to committed teachers who would have the time to branch out. So if you don't have a number of years of teaching under your belt, you're probably not going to have an idea of how to do something differently. Or maybe we need some young blood to think differently, but I think there needs to be, it's going to have to be a generational change, but I think we should keep working on it. Mm-hmm. Reorienting and revaluing our curriculum towards stewardship versus
stewardship and care.
Yeah, stewardship of the earth. I came up with three words that I have on a little school logo for us. I don't know how long I'll stay there, but now I can't remember the third one. communication, stewardship, and
humility, servitude. I don't know.
I'll come back to it. So the goal is to continually call students to everything they're learning is related to one of these things. Mm-hmm. So science and math is for stewardship here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Continually reminding them.
Mm-hmm. Ernst, do you have a remark here?
Oh, I think, like you said, we know what we're trying to, we know the goal. How do we get there? I just keep coming back to the concept of modeling and apprenticing,
yep.
Apprenticing.
Yes, and so what, in our case, when we get to high school, we have nobody looking over our shoulder. We can do anything, we could make that high school diploma whatever we want. Up to eighth grade, there's a little more, it's a little more conformed, but so what should that be when you talk about modeling discipleship, what exactly should that be for our, like, is intercession included?
Oh yeah, that's it.
Is that like
prayer,
something that we ought, like, can someone graduate from my school and not have learned how to fight that way?
The other word is character. So communication,
yeah.
Character,
yeah.
And stewardship. And I was telling my teachers to constantly remind the students of this. Basically everything we're learning in school is related to one of these three words. So whether it's literature, communications, most important skill in life, stewardship of the earth, character,
mm-hmm.
Developing character, becoming like Christ, with Christ at the center.
Well, even in terms of economics, I mean, that's always one of the questions, you know, the three C's for a credit and what's the other one, and character, you know, can you count on that to pay your debt?
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think, I remember years ago in northern Minnesota, John Koblenz,
okay.
And I working together,
mm-hmm.
And just the emphasis I always appreciated that he gave in our little context there was character awards. We had academic awards, but let's give character awards
mm-hmm.
to every student.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Highlighting that
mm-hmm.
value of character.
Are you intending to implement anything there?
So I started last year, and I'm wrestling with how to grow it, but
I had three high schoolers, and so I gave them, I told them ahead of time, give them, we'll get high school credit for the time we spend, but we had a 10-minute slot twice a day. We went into the office and we prayed for four specific requests. Mm-hmm. And we repeated, we changed one of those the entire year.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm not sure if that's the right way, but that's, I think it's pretty significant because it's possible that we can come up in a congregation that follows Jesus and not learn how to intercede.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it shouldn't be possible. But what does the school have a role in that?
Mm-hmm.
Or is that not part of what we're supposed to be doing at school? Mm-hmm. Especially after they have publicly chosen to follow Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be part of discipling?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You see, we break things apart. We have the church, the school, and the home.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. really, it should all be, we're whole.
It should
people.
Be integrated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Learning how to pray is not really any less or more sacred than learning how to do how to write a report, is it? I mean, except it is more important. Because that's how you change the world, but.
And the disciples of Jesus, what
yeah.
did they ask it?
Yeah, teach us to pray.
Teach us to pray.
Teach us how.
You have to learn to pray. You have to be taught.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's just one category I've been thinking about. There are definitely more.
Mm-hmm.
I love your emphasis on humility. That's it's just lacking in our culture.
Oh man, yeah.
My heart yearns for revival, not only my own heart,
mm-hmm.
but in our Anabaptist circles and nationwide. I'm just convinced that humility is a part of that, and prayer, and it takes humility to pray, to admit that we don't have the answers, but He does.
Well, yeah, I don't remember the discussion back that you're referencing, but the kind of forward movement on in those categories, I think, would take time.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly don't oppose them. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I said that day, but in terms of...
The meeting was more about, should we reinvent the wheel or, you know, overthrow and start over? And that's when you said, nah. We don't need to get them there.
Tradition. The value of tradition.
Yeah, there you go. Daniel, you have comments here?
One thing I was thinking about, you know, how do you convey these values?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, probably there are ways to, I'm sure there are, ways to integrate it into the curriculum and into your teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the basic influences is going to be the teacher's lifestyle.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you teach stewardship, but you
mm-hmm.
don't live it out.
Yeah, that's, yeah, I was going kind of a couple different directions as you were talking here. So that's a little bit the example apprenticing model. You had used the word there, apprenticing, and that's good. I almost thought maybe Ireland, maybe the Amish model's not so bad, you know, so the eighth grade minimal stuff, and then put them out there and apprentice them on the farm.
maybe not. But if we have them in school, then what should we be doing? They decided to come, so now what?
Yeah. No, that's good. It's a. Do you feel like the our curriculum writers are doing better in terms of? I mean, some of the more some of the more, what shall I say, prominent problems were clearly the nationalism that was taught in older models. And I know there's been attempts to push back against that and move it. I think you're talking about more thoroughgoing something than that.
I think so.
Do you have any would this be school specific, or do you think we should create some kind of a curriculum that might incorporate more of this?
I'm just thinking, like right now, I'm thinking of the 22 credits that we require for graduation.
Okay, sure.
To pass these, you have to have, you know, something of a passing grade in 22 credits to graduate.
Okay.
Who decided? Like, how did we get to those 22, those categories? Like, where did that come from? And looking at that, we have to admit that that largely came from the nation state.
Mm-hmm.
And, or like you were talking about the, you know, the need to get, to keep going. And so I'm not saying that those are, that that's bunk, but are we stuck to that? Do we just try to breathe humility into all those 22 and then say that's Christian?
Uh-huh.
Or what should those 22 be? Well, what would a credit in breaking yards, or, you know, a credit in, you have to find people in our local town to minister to. You're obligated. I'm not going to help you. Well, maybe I would help you.
Yeah.
But you have to go.
You have to drive.
You have to make the contacts, and you have to offer a service or some sort of service. You know, what would a credit like that, what would it look like? How would you grade it? Should it be there? What should it take the place of? The third year of literature? The second year of math?
Yeah, I was going to say, you still need a certain level of the academic, because I have a sister that's studying to be a nurse. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't go straight from eighth grade to college without some more math or something in there, you know, to get to the college level.
To a certain extent, that's true.
There's some of it that needs to be there, but...
So it would kind of depend on where you're headed. But when I went to Liberal Arts University, I was in upper division. I could have pretty much gone from eighth grade in our school to upper division at the local university. But that's not in every subject area, but there was people in a 3,000 level news writing class that couldn't write complete sentences. So they had to be dumbed down to accommodate them. Anyway, that's an aside.
You talked about community service. One of our presidents, that was his major accomplishment in life before becoming president, was community service. And we didn't much appreciate it.
Which one are you referring to?
Obama.
Oh, okay.
But that was, he was a community service organizer.
There you go.
So that's the way I'm thinking about it. Those 22 credits, are those the right things?
Uh-huh.
And do I devote my life to tweaking those 22? To be more Christ-like, or do I replace them?
You're right. Oh, you're onto something there. Keep working on it. I think you hear faith builders, they wrestle with some of that. So we have Christian ministries. And it's been amazing to me to watch John Copeland's and others try to create some kind of a structure where there's actually there's a reality to Christian ministry. This is what we're doing. They're asking the questions you're asking. How would you grade this? What should be the requirements? Now they're talking subject specific here.
Sure.
But you should. I don't know where the forum for discussion is here, but there's some talk about that kind of thing. And I think you're raising it at a level that I haven't heard raised for a while, and that is that, well, so grant requirements. That is an interesting place to start, to ask, well, is that what we want? Is that, if we were thinking about, if we had the power to create the...
So what if the crying need of a kingdom is someone who can move to the Middle East and die? Mm-hmm. Would my school have produced that person?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good question. Good question. I see it as, what, 2:30 here, and I'm supposed to be closing up shop, so that you have a break between now and 3. Yeah, well, it's been a good roundtable discussion here. I think that, again, if I could just share my burden to hear from the youngest, I think, to the oldest one here at our various levels of responsibility. It's this kind of question that I wish we could wrestle with more. And the administration of schools is not just keeping them... It's not just keeping them afloat. It's thinking carefully about how students are being formed and shaped and what's actually happening. I want to be fair with you, Myra. You're a young man. You're stepping into somebody else's shoes. And are you expecting Matt to return? Or are you?
Yeah, probably next year. But then, I mean... After that, I might move to a lower classroom, but still have a little bit of help for him, you know, and some of those things. But
well, I want to be fair.
Principal.
I want to be fair to you. It's hard to step in and start wrestling with all of this stuff and doing things. But take a year and learn. The accumulation of administrative experience, I think, should push us to where Arlen's at, where we're saying, well, here's something that, why is it this way? How can we begin to address that question without being reckless? And I really think that we have work to do along those lines. I'm not administrating anymore, but I sure do. I like to see innovation and work that's adapting, not adapting us, is forming us for the kingdom's sake and also to minister well to the world we live in. So thank you for your contribution. Sorry that didn't work. There's other information here you can help yourself to. But God be with you as you do your work.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.